And welcome to those just arriving today for the second day of Denko-e Sesshin, celebrating transmission of light appreciation, transmission of appreciation of light. The light that fills the room and fills the universe, that pervades our experience day and night. Such a light can't be grasped or turned away from, which is good reason for celebration. Yesterday's story from this collection of awakening stories of the Zen ancestors, this collection called the Transmission of Light Record. Yesterday's story was about what is Buddha? Buddha is that which does not know. Not knowing is Buddha. Not knowing is most intimate. This means not knowing Buddha as a separate object. Not knowing anything as a separate object, separate from a subject. Not knowing any known separate from a knower. So, in not knowing anything separate from myself, that not knowing, that non-dualistic knowing, can also be called undivided knowing. We talked about this yesterday, that if we say Buddha is not knowing in this divided, split way, that kind of not knowing can also be called knowing in an undivided, unsplit way. Yeah? So that's one way of expressing the light. Keizan Zenji, or Zen ancestor, talked about these stories. All 52 ancestors up to his time, from the Buddha up to his time in Japan. And you could say that all these stories are celebrating this inconceivable light in some unique way. And they're all expressing something about, I would say, they're all expressing something about this light, this Buddha, this not knowing in a divided way, this knowing in an undivided way. And there's many ways of talking about this. So there's two ways of talking about the light already. One of them is called not knowing in this divided knowing kind of way. So not knowing is Buddha. Another way of talking about it is knowing is Buddha. Knowing in this undivided way, where there is no knowing without a separate subject and object. And another way of talking about this light is Buddha nature. And so that's today's Zen story is referring to Buddha nature. And as a preface to this story, because I think this story perfectly expresses this this teaching that I discovered this year and I'm so happy about. So I want to share with you, and you might feel as I'm sharing with you, why is he so happy about this teaching? because it might sound like, it sounds kind of like, I'm not even sure what he's saying, and it sounds like just some clunky words. So as you listen to these clunky words, know that I'm sharing them because I can't help my overflowing joy at discovering these clunky words, because I think they express something very beautiful about our experience. So I'll try to convey it in a way that I understand it, and you ask questions if you don't. So this teaching is from this Zen ancestor named Tsung Mi. I think he was in the, yeah, he lived in the 9th century in China. Called the Golden Age of Zen in China, where it was really, Zen was kind of taking off as this new movement, and all these creative expressions were coming forward all around the country of China. And Tsung Mi was one who had his own creative expressions, but he was also kind of like compiling the other earlier creative expressions of the Zen ancestors and kind of commenting on and comparing them. He was sort of an analyst of Zen in China, which had only been going, you know, a couple hundred years. So he was also greatly influenced by the Flower Ornament Sutra. So that's part of Tsung Mi's unique understanding, comes from the Flower Ornament Sutra. So one of this teaching that makes me very happy is called Nature Origination or Nature Arising. And it's actually the term comes from the Flower Ornament Sutra. But Tsung Mi picked up on this and he said, this is the heart of the Zen understanding. Nature origination as compared to dependent origination or dependent arising. In Japanese it's shogi, nature arising or origination, and engi, dependent arising or origination. So and Tsung Mi said these are two different causal models of how things come to be. Two different ways of describing how things come to be. And I think a lot of us in the realm of Buddha Dharma have heard about this dependent arising, dependent co-arising as a kind of causal model, right, for how things come to be. From the earliest teachings of the Buddha up through all the centuries of Buddha Dharma since that time, dependent co-arising has been this thread and beautiful, exquisite and yet simple description of how things are. Basically, dependent arising is everything arises dependent on conditions other than itself. Everything comes to be dependent on other things which themselves arose dependent on other things, which themselves arose dependent on other, which themselves arose dependent on other beginninglessly. So there was no start to this process and there's no end to this process. And because things arise dependent on others, they have no independent existence. Right? They're just everything, both what we call the phenomenal world of things and also the internal world of thoughts and feelings. Every possible experience arises dependent on conditions. Yeah? That's kind of simple, and yet something we can contemplate the rest of our life, the implications of it. Dependent arising. Standard Buddha Dharma. All schools of Buddhism agree on dependent arising as a kind of causal model. And in addition to that, there's another causal model called nature arising that's expressed in this flower ornament sutra. Nature here is just short for Buddha nature. And Buddha nature, as Sun Mi describes in many places, is actually this very knowing. So that's why we're talking about this undivided knowing. Comes in many names. Today's name for it is Buddha nature. In Sanskrit, sometimes Buddha nature is the translation of the Sanskrit Tathagata Garbha, or the heart, or the essence of the Thus Come One, the Buddha. And this knowing is like the source, and it's who we really are, actually. It's like, dare I say, it's like our true identity. In Buddhism, we say there's no, a big part of Buddha teaching is no self, right? So and Buddha says, don't identify with anything as yourself, the Buddha taught over and over. So we might say, wait a second, now we're identifying ourself with this knowing awareness. But I think maybe it's okay to do that because Buddha said, don't identify yourself with anything, and this is not a thing. So maybe okay to say, this is our true identity. The later Buddhist tradition started calling this knowing awareness a self. Actually, a kind of transcendent self, a self that's gone beyond identification with any particular thing, like the body and mind. I think usually that's what most humans and sentient beings identify with as themselves, is we feel like, I am this body and mind. Doesn't it often seem like, at first glance, don't we feel as if I am this body and mind? We even talk that way, like, you know, this is me, right? This is me. Me is myself, my identity is this body. Or like we feel as if these thoughts and feelings, they are me. So this mind is thoughts and feelings and mental experiences, and the body is solid, you know, physicality. In the old days, they talked about the four elements, the four material elements, earth, wind, fire, and water. That's my physical self, and my mental self is these thoughts and feelings. That's, I think, normal for us to think this way. But that's what the Buddha says. Don't identify with the body and mind as oneself. Earliest Buddhist teachings is when the five skandhas were taught, five aggregates are basically body and mind. And the Buddha would go through and say, form, this body, this physical body is not myself. Feelings, these feelings are not actually myself. Conceptions and, you know, naming things, dualistic identification with things is not myself. Karmic formations, habitual patterns, my, you know, personality tendencies, these are not myself. And even consciousness, which is, again, vijnana, the divided knowing of subject and object, dualistic knowing, that's not myself either. He didn't say that undivided knowing is not myself. So, Sun Mi says, also, Sun Mi has a brilliant exposition of how sudden and gradual awakening go together. And just for the flavor of Sungmi, this is, he says, he defines this sudden awakening or sudden enlightenment in the Zen tradition in this way. Sudden awakening means that although beings have been deluded from beginningless time, taking these four elements of physicality or materiality to be their body, and thoughts and feelings to be their mind, when they meet a good friend who points out the ultimate, or points out the unconditioned as compared to the conditioned, points out true nature or reality as compared to appearances, points out essence compared to function, then they suddenly realize that this wondrous knowing and seeing itself is the true mind, originally empty and tranquil, boundless and signless, the Dharmakaya itself, or the reality body. They realize that this knowing and seeing, this very knowing, this awareness right now, is actually the true reality. And it's originally empty and tranquil, and it's boundless, it has no boundaries or edges, and it's signless, it has no graspable signs or characteristics. And that is like who they realize they truly are, is this knowing, not the material body and not the mental thoughts and feelings.
So how does that differ from the Hindu concept of self?
Yeah, pretty similar. The Hindu concept of Atman, or self. is very similar, I think. And so that's why many people in many Buddhists over the centuries, when this Buddha nature, Tathagatagarbha teaching started to flower in India, China, and Japan, people said, that sounds like Hindu teaching of Atman. And the Buddhists tried to come up with little wiggling ways to distinguish themselves, to almost to like support their identity as Buddhists. They came up with things like they called it, instead of just calling it a straight up Atman, they called it the Atman Paramita. It means like the self that's gone beyond. The self beyond self. Like, that's what makes it Buddhist. And then some people are like, well, what's the difference really? And they say, And maybe sometimes they get into, I guess we'd have to maybe study the Hindu or Vedantic tradition, maybe more in depth to not, misrepresent them, right, in such a conversation. But, I think sometimes the Buddhists say, they'll, to make the Buddhist point of the Buddha's always teaching about non-grasping of any self and emptiness. And I think you can find that in the Vedanta tradition too, but they would say maybe this, you know, the Buddhist critique of the Vedantic tradition might be sometimes that there's a little bit of something, you know, graspable there in that tradition. And I imagine that the Vedantists would say, no, there's not. That's not how we talk about self. So it's a little bit like, I think they're discovering basically the same thing, because there's only one reality. But maybe in talking about it, it actually, it can get kind of nuanced. And maybe we could say that of Vedanta and Buddhism, maybe Buddhism emphasizes a little bit more of the negating side. The emphasis is more, there's a lot of emphasis on emptiness and you know, shunyata, prajnaparamita, just an emphasis in that direction. Although, of course, you can find that in Hindu Vedantic thought, like neti neti, means not this, not this, not that, not that, not this, not who am I? Well, not this, not that. So, yeah, that could be a long discussion. And it has been a long discussion in the Buddhist tradition. Yes?
I learned something just this last week in reading that when the Big Bang happened 3.5-4 million years ago, that was the start of everything. That was the first flash. And there was one element that came out of it, of which we all evolved into all the other elements and us and this planet, and it was hydrogen. And there was nothing but hydrogen for a couple of billion years. And then they started, through different celestial processes, merging into more complicated matter, material, elements. And then came the Earth, and then came life, and then came us, and then our awareness of that.
So that's like a common scientific story.
Yes.
Yeah. And so this teaching of nature origination is kind of like the reverse of that story.
Yes.
So that story starts with the Big Bang, which creates hydrogen, which creates other elements, which creates sentient beings, which creates awareness.
Yes.
It's so the nature origination's kind of literally the reverse. Like you can take that whole timeline in a way, not exactly timeline, but that causal model. That's a causal model.
Yes.
And we could say that's dependent co-arising.
Yes, it is.
Whereas nature origination starts with before the Big Bang.
Yes, right.
Starts with
before the Big Bang. There was something.
Well, in this model, that something is called knowing. Before, not to mention before sentient beings, but before the Big Bang.
Yeah.
Or in Zen we say before our parents were born, our original face. Right? But if we could say, we could modernize it and say, what's your original face before the Big Bang? So this is the nature origination model. First there's knowing, and we can say, well, how could there be knowing without sentient beings? Well, let's not get into that. But if we're saying that there could be knowing without sentient beings, then obviously that kind of knowing is not a knowing with a subject and an object, right? If there's a knowing before the Big Bang, it's not a knowing that involves senses or even sentient beings, right? Or objects. Before the Big Bang, there was no universe. So this is a knowing prior to the universe. And then from that beginning, so this is actually nature origination. That's what we call Buddha nature before the Big Bang. And then the Big Bang actually arises from Buddha nature in this model. This is just models, right? There's people like trying to understand how things are. And then from, you know, starting with Buddha nature or knowing or awareness, then we could say what that starts like, different ways of talking about it. It starts, you know, vibrating within itself, and that vibration, the first vibration we call the Big Bang, and then it continues to this vibration continues to evolve past the Big Bang into solar systems and planets, and pretty soon, not pretty soon, but actually a while, right? in human terms, at some point you get this particular planet called Earth, and with a lot of hydrogen on it, and a carbon is part of the story here, and then eventually you get what we call sentient beings and these primitive life forms. And, you know, these are way, way, way after awareness or knowing in this model. But now we might say these are the types of beings that actually, basically these sentient beings are the ones that can do this divided knowing. We could say, they may be even the first types of knowing in the universe that can do this thing called dualistic consciousness. We could say that awareness was around long before, but we call sentient beings from the most primitive forms can do this division, and that's what we call sentient beings. So in your original model, it would be like we say that's the miracle of the first awareness, but I would say that's the miracle of the first delusion. Is sentient beings.
And that's the delusion we're dealing with right now.
Right now, yes.
Climate crisis and being able to come together to save the planet, but we continue to destroy it.
Yeah, yes.
So, commonly the implication of knowing and consciousness emanates from a process that takes place in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're talking about is not.
That's right, yeah. But we, and still, you know, we're distinguishing some terms here, like from yesterday. One side is, we talked about two kinds of knowing yesterday. One that I'm calling consciousness, because it's the standard translation of vijnana, means divided knowing, and, which means the appearance of a subject and an object. That's consciousness. Whereas I would call awareness, or undivided knowing, is this other type. And we could say, I think, to talk about coming from the brain, we could say this divided consciousness is particularly connected with what we call the brain.
But not coming from the brain.
That's
processed through the brain.
Yeah.
But not originated in the brain.
Yeah. We could even say that this, and we're putting aside awareness, non-dual awareness, we're not going to even try to relate this one to the brain, but the consciousness, you see the distinction? Consciousness meaning dualistic knowing. That one, I would say has like a interdependent relationship with the brain. Not exactly that it comes from the brain or that the brain comes from it, but the brain and the dualistic consciousness arise together. For example, brain, as we know it right now, is actually an idea of dualistic consciousness. So that's one way we could say that the brain, as we know it, actually, in a way, comes from consciousness. That's the model of dependent arising. So over on the left hand here is the is dualistic consciousness, divided knowing, and which also is related to dependent co-arising. Because dependent co-arising means there's a bunch of different things that arise dependent on each other. It's the realm of difference and multiplicity. On this side is the realm of non-dual awareness, undivided knowing, where there's no multiplicity. There's actually total unity. There's no separation. And actually in this realm, nothing even arises or ceases. This is kind of the way that it fits into the kind of Buddhist story, even like the Heart Sutra. Yes.
I started reading Suzuki Roshi's talk on the branching streams from the darkness.
Yeah.
And the whole beginning of it is the Sang Lokai.
Yes.
Similar with the one of the words meaning many.
Mm-hmm.
One of the words meaning one, and then the Kai is the thing that's sort of
the unity
or
we say merging of difference and unity, mm-hmm. or harmony of difference and equality. And that will fit into this story too, of nature origination, which is not finished yet.
So when we talk about spontaneous recognition of non-duality, does that depend on codependent arising?
The recognition, the spontaneous recognition. Oh, that's an interesting question. Yeah. In a way, we could say, from Sung-mi's perspective, we could say, actually, that's like nature arising. The Buddha nature expresses itself as a recognition of itself.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't, that recognition, I would say, for now, then maybe it doesn't depend on anything, especially if you say it's like spontaneous, right? But we could say, from another perspective, we could say, you know, if you're sitting a lot of zazen, for example, and hearing a lot of Dharma teachings, then those recognitions tend to like spontaneously appear more often. So, maybe. And if so, then you could say that it seems that there seems to be some relationship, that there seems to be like the recognition seems to be dependent on some certain conditions. So in a way we could talk about both of those.
Right.
Sides. Yes.
And like with direct transmission,
mm-hmm.
it seems like that, you know, you have the realization of the teacher pointing out opening.
Yeah.
And then the recognition. Seems like that.
Yeah.
Independent arising. And yeah.
And yeah. And yet, well, this fits nicely into the story of nature arising. Do you want to ask something to,
yeah.
clarify before we...
Oh, yeah, why do you say Buddha nature recognizing itself is its expression, I think you said, as opposed to Buddha nature merely expressing itself? What does it have to... the recognition?
You could say everything is an expression of Buddha nature. That's actually what nature origination is referring to. But the recognition, because Corrine used the word recognition, you could say recognizing our nature is like, I think what we usually mean by that is when a sentient being, a deluded sentient being, remembers who they are. Right? So it's kind of recognizing that who they are is Buddha nature, like this Sunmi's story about sudden awakening is all these beings deluded from beginningless time have this pointed out. He even uses the word pointing out. There, a good friend points out the ultimate and the distinction between the ultimate and the relative, the nature and the appearance. And then they suddenly recognize that this wondrous knowing and seeing is itself reality. So you could say that's kind of, the recognition is in a way for sentient beings, because you could say the Buddha nature is always recognizing itself beginninglessly and endlessly. This very knowing is always knowing itself, even when me and you don't necessarily recognize that. Right? That's why there's all these teachings in Zen, like, and in fact, this chapter from the Flower Ornament Sutra, where this term nature arising comes from, has the famous statement, one of the most famous statements from the Flower Ornament Sutra. It goes like this. The Buddha says, strange, how strange. How can it be that although sentient beings are fully possessed of the knowing of the Tathagata, the Buddha knowing, and it's this word, Tathagata jnana. Yesterday we talked about jnana means knowing or awareness. All beings are fully possessed of this Buddha knowing or awareness, but because of ignorance and confusion, they don't recognize that. Right? Therefore, I should teach them the noble path, enabling them to forever leave false thoughts and attachments and perceive this great knowing of the Tathagata within themselves, not different from the Buddhas. So in that way, we all share this Tathagata jnana, this Buddha nature that's always knowing itself. But we as sentient beings are so into this dualistic consciousness from the beginning of our life, that we could say that illusion of duality is what obscures the non-dual knowing. They're very similar in many ways, right? Like, I look out there and see you, and like, there is a knowing, a dualistic knowing, but it feels as if I'm over here seeing you over there. That's dualistic consciousness. And you could say that's very similar to Tathagata jnana or Buddha nature. The only difference is in the Buddha knowing, it still appears maybe as if you're over there. We still can perceive in the same way. But we know that you are nothing other than the knowing of you. You are this knowing. That's what we were talking about yesterday. We hear the sound and we try to investigate what is this experience of sound. Where does the experiencing of the sound meet the experience of the sound? And we find they don't meet, because there is no experience of sound other than the experiencing of it. Or where does the knowing of the sound meet this known sound? It doesn't meet. Because first we have to find a known sound apart from the knowing of it. And that's our work of investigation. Can we find a sound apart from the knowing of it?
When a tree falls in the woods.
When a tree falls in the woods, well.
If we're not there, does it exist?
Yeah, we don't know. Because we're not there. All we know is trees falling in the vicinity. And then we know that sound. And then that sound is nothing other than the knowing of it. And the tingling in the knees, this physical sensation, where does our awareness meet that sensation? I'm proposing that it doesn't meet. There's no meeting in this realm. As soon as there's meeting, it's duality. Right? The tingling sensation that we're experiencing is nothing other than the knowing of the sensation. So this is very experiential, right? It might sound theoretical, but this is something you can really directly explore. Yes? Sorry.
How about the unconscious processes? Do they fit in to the consciousness model, or do they have anything to do with the non-dual awareness?
Like what would be an example of unconscious?
Well, there are many. I believe there are many unconscious processes going on in our psyche and in the world. There are many things we are unconscious about.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's our heart beating.
Yeah, there are somatic.
Somatic things.
Somatic processes and also the mental processes.
In a way, I think we could say that at the time that they're completely unconscious, meaning that they're not even having an influence on us, because if they're having an influence on our actions, then in a way they're subtly conscious, or they're revealing themselves through our actions. But if they're just latent and not having any particular influence on us in this moment, then at that time we could say they're not really there. We don't know them. So they're not, it's almost like they don't exist at that time until they come into consciousness, and then we know them, and then they are the knowing. But we could talk about a kind of potential, so Buddhism has the story of the storehouse consciousness, which is like all the latent unconscious, patterns that are waiting for conditions to reveal them. So, in that way, you could say that, yes, you could say that that's part of the, Buddha knowing. It's just a kind of unconscious knowing. We could talk about it like that too. Because in fact, I don't want to get too into it, because we have a whole class on Sung-mi sometime, but he's part of his comparison is the schools that say the storehouse consciousness is separate from the Buddha nature, and then some schools of Buddhism that says actually they're the same. The storehouse consciousness is a kind of diluted version of Buddha nature. Or it is just Buddha nature actually.
I don't want to get too off here, but your discussion with Stan, or that your clarification of the Big Bang, in a way reminded me of something Spinoza said, which his belief that God was merely nature, or more particularly, like, God is merely all the laws of, like, the universe, for example.
Mm.
And so, and I found that kind of, to me, it seems like that relates in a way, because it's like, you know, these atoms have knowing or some kind of expression, and then, you know, building up to who we are. But then I was starting to think that the term knowing is a bit confusing, because if we say all these atoms and then sentient beings are an expression of Buddha nature, we might say something like, this wood is maybe nature, right? And we don't say that the atoms know.
No.
Right? They just are an expression.
That's right.
And so, but I wonder, even as like a sentient being, or as humans using this language, why we use the word knowing, because it seems like we just, I mean, I guess, I don't know, maybe that's just how we say we are Buddha. I don't know how we are. Though getting caught in the word, it seems really easy to get caught in the word knowing in a way.
Well, we have to remember that too, these two different kinds, right? We're talking about a non-dual knowing with no separate subject and object. And I like the word knowing. I also like the word awareness. And I like the word experiencing. These are my three favorite words these days. They're synonymous. And it's nice to alternate between them so we don't get stuck in any one. I like them better, for example, better than Buddha nature, because they're very experiential terms. And I think to keep it from getting theoretical or even mystical or too narrowly Buddhist or something like that, I like the word knowing, because we're talking about this present knowing. I think it's good in these discussions to keep coming back to actually our direct experience, which is, we're talking about this knowing. This knowing, which may be distorted if we're projecting appearances outside of ourself, but it's still the same knowing, this awareness. And when we get into the qualities of awareness, like it's beginningless and endless and unchanging, then we can really explore it in our own experience, apart from big bangs and things like this. Like, are we aware right now, right? It's undeniable. It's the one, I would say, one undeniable reality is that there is knowing here, or there is experiencing, right? If we say, no, there's no experiencing happening here, then we can't say that, right? To say it, to be able to listen and think and exist, or to be a person, that means there's every moment of our life is experiencing or knowing or awareness. And so this is why this Buddha knowing is ever present. And it's just, as the Buddha said, it's just that sentient beings distort it. We could say even just slightly distort it by thinking that there's a sound other of a siren, other than the knowing of that sound. That's just that slight delusion creates like the whole mess of samsara. Yes.
I guess I don't question whether I don't question whether awareness is
present.
I want to put in possibly present. I feel like there's layers, and that distraction occludes the awareness.
So that's a nice point. I would say that the awareness that I'm speaking of now doesn't change the slightest when we're completely distracted.
Right, it's there, but
we don't recognize it.
We're in the conscious.
Yes.
Mind.
Yes. Right.
And before that thought came, that experience, I was having an experience. There were a lot of words, and for me to be in awareness, I have to go really slow with less words. And so I felt the inner struggle. I experienced the inner struggle. And the question that came up was, I don't know if I'll be able to still remember what the question was, but can we even explore these thoughts? Can we try to understand these thoughts and do it from other than the conscious mind? Because I was not able to stay with...
Yeah. I think I see what you're saying. So I like the Buddha's story of these three kinds of wisdom. I don't know if you've heard this one. It's another model that we're sort of overlapping now. So hopefully this model won't get too complicated. But the first kind of wisdom is the wisdom from hearing and reading conceptual teachings. And the Buddha says, if we don't do this first, we're probably going to fall into some just old habitual way of understanding. So we get, of course, we have Dharma, right? And it comes in words and teachings. And it's conceptual and dualistic and intellectual and all of these things that might distract us from direct awareness. So, but that's only the first step. And if we stay there, it's just more distraction. But we're clarifying, we're creating models. I like this word, models. It's like we're creating conceptual models, and yes, we admit this is completely the conceptual realm we're doing. That's the first type of wisdom. The next type is maybe what you're talking about. Can we even explore these things without being really conceptual? It's a layer deeper called the wisdom of reflecting on, which is now applying the conceptual models to our direct experience. It's still conceptual, but it's blending the conceptual ideas with our direct experience. Like the example is, we have this practice that comes in words, like listen to the sound and try to investigate, can we find a sound other than the knowing of the sound? Can we find a physical sensation other than the knowing of it? It comes in a conceptual package, but that's, as we start to explore that, we have to let go of the, you know, words a little bit and start to actually, directly look. We're still using words and concepts, but it's getting less conceptual. And then the third layer of wisdom is where it's truly non-conceptual, where you're actually listening to the sound of the bird, and it's actually... it's not a sound other than the knowing. It is the knowing of it. It is Buddha nature, and no separation whatsoever. But to get to that point, some Zen people, I think, might say, let's skip the first two kinds because they just distract us and they get us into this conceptual mind. That is often in the Zen tradition. We try to go directly underneath. I think that's valid. But the nice thing about the first two conceptual kinds is they hone our mind. They hone our practice, I feel like, really clarifies exactly what we mean by duality. Because we can say, well, just rest, and it seems like everything's just one. But then we're like, well, what was that? We just kind of dropped into it somehow. This is more like a reliable pathway down into it. So then we can, like, over time, we don't need so many words. It's a Dharma talk, so there's lots of words. But eventually we can get so we just hear the sound of the bird and we remember all three layers like in one moment. So this is maybe just my personality too. Like for me, it really works to do the conceptual clarification, more and more fine tuning it, because I know it works because there were many ways that I understood even non-duality and awareness in the past that now I see were really not quite right. They were close, but they were close but no cigar. So that's what I like it. But it's not for everybody. It's my samskaras. It's my what works. I have a very active thinking mind, so I have to, like, if I don't use it in this clarification way, I get very active thinking about stupid, useless stuff. That's right. That's right. So anyway, can I continue? Thank you very much. Nature arising. This is Sung Mi. He says, because, so talking about the Flower Ornament Sutra and nature arising, Sung Mi says, there's not a single phenomena that is not a manifestation of this fundamental mind or awareness. There's not a single phenomena that's not a manifestation or an expression of this knowing. Because in this teaching of nature arising, this true nature is transparent, mysterious, and bright. It is naturally always the myriad phenomena. Its quiescence, the quiescence and stillness of awareness itself, is the quiescence and stillness of the myriad phenomena. That everything that appears, all of us in this room, the movement that's happening right now, is actually, it's just an expression of the stillness. So this is total stillness, right, from the nature arising perspective. Its true nature is total stillness, but it appears, it's expressed as movement and activity. And therefore, body and mind, big mind, body and awareness are not two. Body is a manifestation or expression of this awareness. And Dogen comments on body and mind in very much the same way. They can't be separated. And some of the commentators on that say, he doesn't mean just like body and dualistic consciousness, because they can be spoken of as separate or interdependent. But the unity of body and mind, Dogen speaks of, is this knowing awareness that is the body, or the body is it. They are one unity. And now if our identity is this knowing, instead of the limited body and mind, this limited body and mind is me, now we step back into who I really am, it, and who you really are, is just this boundless knowing. It's expressing itself as a body and a mind, and as a room, and a town, and a world. So from this perspective of nature arising, everything is equally an expression of Buddha nature. So my true identity now does include this body and mind, and your bodies and minds and the world. And the radical thing about this is equally, so from this deep nature origin, nature origination perspective, which I admit this is a very, you know, in any, it's very hard to open to this for more than a moment because it's so radical. But this is more like, I, who I really am, includes everything. So it includes this body and mind and Corrine's body and mind equally. Not like this body and mind is a little bit more me than her body and mind. And it includes like this book and the Zendo equally. All these things are equally me. That's why you can imagine the implications of if the Buddhas realize this completely, how does one live in such a way, right? One does, of course, still take care of this body and mind because it's precious me, but also take care of your bodies and minds as me, and take care of the book as me, you know. This is like, you can imagine maybe how, or you can explore even how this really can make sense as a model of reality, and how different it is than our usual thing, where we might be interdependent, We can see that much. That's the model of dependent arising. We can see how we're interdependent, but that's different than saying, you are me. I am you. And I am this whole universe equally. So, of course, great love and compassion comes forth from that. I was in this wedding ceremony recently, last weekend. Yeah, I attended it. Yeah, I was actually part of it. There's these lines from the, this is, I think, San Francisco Zen Center wedding ceremony that I don't know who wrote them, but they're very beautiful. And the lines go like, in a Buddhist wedding, we're married body to body, mind to mind, nature to nature, and true nature to true nature. I thought, that's very cool. And I thought, I think nature here means, I would understand it as like our personality. Our human nature, yeah, our human nature. And then our true nature is our Buddha nature. And I thought, the first three types, like maybe body, mind, and human nature, we do this particular wedding in a particular way with a particular person. But the last type, we're married true nature to true nature, that's the way we're all married, right? Beginninglessly and endlessly, we are equally married. My spouse is equally married to me as, aunt in Africa. Or Donald Trump. I love my hubby, Don. Exactly. And that's the part, like, you know, we can't get divorced from that marriage. And no problem with that marriage. The other ones are like a little scarier. Right? You're gonna have to deal with this person forever and ever. Yes, that's where those are like the personal vows and the personal practice. It can be challenging, but I think it's much less challenging if we remember how we're married to true nature to true nature. So, I'm so sorry.
Oh. Get to know the name of him. He hasn't even walked in the room.
He hasn't walked in the room. Oh, man. That's right. Here's how I tried to write my own summary of these comparing dependent arising and nature arising, just to finish this story for now. Dependent arising is an explanation for how experiences conventionally appear to arise dependent on each other, which includes how experiences are dependent on the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body, and the mind. So this includes, like, Nagarjuna's middle way teachings, and also mind-only teachings of how things depend on mind. I think it includes both of those. Whereas nature arising is, I feel like, and Sung Mi says, goes a step deeper than even those beautiful Mahayana teachings. He said, nature arising, this is my way of putting it, is an explanation, a model, of what appearances ultimately are. It's actually a misnomer, since ultimately appearances don't really arise. All appearances or experiences are simply manifestations or expressions of awareness or knowing or Buddha nature. The sound of the bird is not actually arising. It's experienced due to dependent arising, but ultimately in reality it's nothing more than the awareness or knowing or experiencing of the sound. This knowing as which everything appears could also be called emptiness. I'll just read you this story, and then we'll stop and go into it this afternoon. The 13th ancestor was Venerable Kapimala. We say Kapimala Dayosho. One time, Venerable Ashvaghosha spoke of the ocean of Buddha nature. Now you can see why we call it an ocean, right? Boundless ocean of Buddha nature, saying, mountains, rivers, and the great earth appear dependent on and established as Buddha nature. Here it says, mountains, rivers, and the great earth appear dependent on Buddha nature. The three kinds of spiritual knowledge and the six supernatural powers of Indian Buddhism appear from Buddha nature. And Kapimala, hearing this, was awakened. So you can maybe see why I thought this was a perfect time to bring up this nature arising, because I think that's what this is saying. Buddha, everything is arising as an expression of Buddha nature. The mountains, rivers, and earth appear as Buddha nature, the ocean of Buddha nature. One other Lex Hickson's kind of interpretive translation and commentary, he actually puts in the waves there as a maybe way of helping to deal with this difficult kind of topic. The ocean of Buddha nature, he says, mountains, rivers, and the great earth appear as waves on the ocean of Buddha nature. And this is a different causal model. These are two different causal models, and they don't depend. Nature arising doesn't negate dependent arising, but in a way, you could say it's the deeper ground from which dependent arising functions. And Sunmi, in his kind of analysis of the Zen schools, he said the southern school of Zen, this was before Soto and Rinzai branched out, but there were still this southern and northern lineages, and he said the southern school of Zen, of which Soto and Rinzai are both part, is based on nature origination. And the northern school that died out, actually, was based more on dependent origination. Didn't go into this deeper layer of non-duality. May our intention equally extend to every being in place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.